Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com and Global Research TV at grtv.ca, and it is the 20th of February 2012. And today we're honored to be joined on the line from Beijing, China by Dr. Thorsten Patberg, who is a German scholar at the Institute of World Literature of Peking University. He's also the author of The East-West Dichotomy and Shengren. So, Dr. Patberg, thank you so much for coming on today. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, James. Pleasure is mine.
No problem. Well, let's start by talking about a very interesting article that was recently posted to globalresearch.ca, penned by yourself, and it's running under the headline Language, Imperialism, Concepts, and Civilization, China versus the West. A very interesting article talking about language imperialism. So perhaps we can start by telling people about that concept and what it entails.
Well, actually, first I would like to make a distinction between linguistic imperialism and language imperialism. Linguistic imperialism says a dominant language replaces another one. And actually, I'm not at all against the idea that we share global language. That's all right with me. Language imperialism is different. It is about picking up key foreign concepts and translating them into something familiar and convenient in your own vocabulary. And you do that by either claiming what I call the prerogative or final explanation over that concept, or by simply diminishing another people's originality, or by claiming that you have full comprehension of a foreign topic by switching into your own lingua. That's language imperialism.
Interesting. Well, let's look at some of the ways that that works and how it functions then. So specifically in your article, for instance, you mentioned some Chinese concepts that have no English equivalent. So let's start talking about some of the specific ways that people confuse certain terms.
Well, I was mainly interested in the translation of the Shengren, for instance. The Shengren is traditionally translated as either philosopher or a saint. But the philosopher obviously is a Hellenic tradition, it's Greek origin, and the saint has a biblical connotation. So I was looking into this translation, and I started at 1649, actually, and I picked the Confucian Analects, the Lun Yu in Chinese. And I just looked at the history, the translation history of this word, Shengren. And what popped out immediately was that various cultures in Europe translate the Shengren and other concepts as well, according to their own, you know, preconceptions. I found that rather striking. So is this really scientific if you project your own culture onto another? And you know, in the end, I figured out the Shengren is actually neither a philosopher nor a saint, nor anything else we have in Europe or in America. It's simply its own concept, a bit like the Buddhas, maybe, of Buddhism.
Well, that is a fascinating example, and I think it does get to the heart of the issue. But in your article, you talk about a different term, Wenming, and this is one that I must admit I have a total ignorance of. I'd never heard of it until your article, but I think it's a particularly interesting one looking at the political context and how political misunderstanding can happen through this as well.
That's right. Well, it has a political connotation, but I would like to stress a cultural one. Politics is always a bit tricky. Culturally speaking, the Wenming is a Chinese concept that exists for 5,000 of years, and it's basically, you know, you can read about it, the Wen and the Ming in the Chinese classics, and it means something like, you know, enlightened by literature or literate people, whereas the Western concept of civilization is obviously Greek origin, etymologically speaking, but it was only invention in the 19th century when we talked about civilization. So it means something like mastering technology of the city people. It has to do, if we think about civilization in the West, we think about architecture and technology mainly. When the Chinese talk about Wenming, they think about the level of maturity of a people's intellect and the level of high literature, basically. It's literate concept. Mm.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and I imagine that English was not your first language, that I'm assuming you're a German speaker. What are some of the other examples you've encountered in different languages that might be interesting for English speakers in the audience?
Well, I've nothing against translation, but there are simple things we should not translate in order to show respect to other cultures. And a good example, maybe you're located in Japan, would be the Tenno of Japan. The Tenno is often loosely translated as emperor, which is fine. It's all right. But now think about the following example. If there's a conference of German speakers and Japanese speakers, and they decide on the topic of the conference, what will it be? And the Germans say, let's talk about the Japanese Kaiser. The Kaiser is a German word for the German emperor, the German Kaiser. Now, if the Japanese are they're naturally nice people, if they agree to talk about the Kaiser, they give away the prerogative of final explanation over that concept to the German professors who attend the conference. Because, culturally speaking, they are the only experts on the Kaiser. They have it in the German tradition forever, the word, you know, the history that come with the words. And the other example would be if they now switch to Tenno, that would be the other way around. Now the Japanese becoming experts because the Tenno is clearly not German. It is Japanese culture is a brilliant one. It's very different from the European one. So the Tenno is something very uniquely Japanese. So that would be an example, the Tenno Kaiser Emperor. Yeah.
Right, another good example. So you made an interesting and I think important correction to my question earlier when I asked about the political connotations of something like Wenming, and you said, well, it's more of a cultural mindset. And I think that speaks to maybe the heart of this issue, because it seems to me to reinforce the fact that culture really underpins so much of our political context and other things that seem to grow out of a vast culture and thousands of years of history. And that's something that I think is well reflected in when we look at something like language imperialism. Can you speak to what do you think is the relationship between the way that we use words and language and then the types of worldview that we have as a result of that?
Well, I believe that we are still living in a world that was determined, like it started 300 years ago, basically with Western, the age of imperialism. And there are a lot of mistakes were done that now today we know better and we could correct them if we wanted to. There's the major example when the Jesuits moved to China starting 17th century, you know, onwards. There was I have a famous quote by Randall Taylor at 1691, I think. And he wrote a sentence and he said, like, his impression is that the missionaries in China seem all to believe that Confucius foresaw the coming of the Messiah. So they assumed that Confucianism was a pre-Christian, you know, construct. So that when became Confucius became a religion in, you know, in connotation marks, because it's not really a religion, but already the preconcept was there. And from there onwards, you know, people quoting people and become a story wrongly told. And let me give you an example of, or make it clear what I mean. When Christopher Columbus discovered North America, he famously called the Native Americans Indians. It was an error, a blunder of epic proportion, let's say, but we never corrected it quite. Today we call them Indianas, while they are really not. And of course, Christopher Columbus said, they seem to have no religion here, so that we can't make them easily turn them into Christian. So the first island Christopher Columbus has encountered, he called Los Santos, Saint Kitts, Saint Croix. So these all saint, it means, you know, holy man, like that's what he did. And he chose his name for these islands. It were actually the Bahamas and Cuba. But you see, already we used our language to, you know, suppress all the others. And something similar happened in China. They translated all the Chinese key concept into biblical or philosophical terminologies.
So then proscriptively, what really can we do to counteract this? Is it a question of simply trying to incorporate other words into our own worldview to try to understand them as they are? Or is there some other way to approach that?
Well, yeah, we could do this. Actually, it's all about limitation. I think, being frankly, they're not evil people. You know, the missionaries were very good people, but it's all about limitation of our active vocabulary. But now, 21st century, we have all this technology at hand. We actually could improve in our vocabulary, you know, the scope of vocabulary. I mean, we could not simply, if you see a thinker in China, it's so easy to annotate it with Chinese, that word Chinese, you know, it's a Chinese philosopher. Actually, what you're saying is, it's not a philosopher, it's a Chinese philosopher. So it's something similar, but we make it, because we are limited in vocabulary, we make it limited. But actually now, we don't have to do this really. information is out there. Everyone can look it up in the real text and see. It's not a philosopher. It's a Shengren in this instance. So we are much more advanced and knowledgeable than we were before.
Well, that is interesting, and that's a perspective that unfortunately a lot of English speakers probably don't have, simply because they are not as frequently forced to come up against that in their own daily personal lives, unless they go traveling, for instance, or go to a different culture. So it is something that unfortunately the linguistic imperialism of English has enabled that sort of coziness. So I guess on a final note, then you're in China right now, which of course is becoming more important to the West in terms of its economic position, geopolitical wranglings that are going on right now. What do you think that people in the West can or should be looking into in terms of Chinese language in order to better understand that culture and civilization?
Well, the best way to learn another culture is to learn that language. There's no way around it. But we're speaking about China. It's really cultural speaking. It's a golden age. People talk too much about markets and globalism, you know, in form of finance and markets and consumerism. But I think there's another world opening up, and that's the world of culture. They have done things for thousands of years and developed it quite nicely. Very different ways, you know, were chosen by the Chinese than we chose in the West. And they are so eagerly studying Western European American culture these days. We should return the favor. We should, like Ji Xianlin, a famous Chinese thinker, said, it's basically like we received, you know, a fruit from the West, and we should return them a plum, you know, something in return. We should start to learn and appreciate Chinese culture and to adopt many more Chinese concepts.
Absolutely. Well, what do you say to people who are confronted with this type of issue, but don't fail to see the why it's an important point? I mean, a lot of people see things that are so-called soft imperialism, like language imperialism, as a minor issue compared to the major issues of politics or things like that. What do you say to people who don't quite understand why this is an important issue?
Well, because if they want to find, I don't want to say the word truth, because, you know, truth is very vague. What is truth? We don't really know. But it's more correct to choose concepts like Wenming, I explained, or Shengren or Junzhou or other Chinese concepts. Like, actually, think about yin and yang and kung fu and all these great, great concepts from the East. And it's much more respectful to the civilization. And it also enhances our own knowledge and understanding. So it's only positive. There is no, you know, no trading, really. It's a good thing overall, I think.
All right. Well, on that note, Dr. Thorsten Patberg, absolutely interesting. So thank you very much for your time. And finally, where can people go to find out more about yourself and your work?
Well, it's, you know, I have my website. I recently set it up. It's East-West Dichotomy. You can read a bit about it. You know, it's not really starting off, but this is a good starting point.
All right. Okay. On that note, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.